I'm Jesse Brown, and today, a story about what happens when doctors help you put an end to your own life.
We went from doing something that would have put us in jail to something that was considered compassionate health care almost overnight.
Wait for that. Let's start with a quick recap on where we're at with MAID, medical assistance in dying. 2016, it became legal for doctors to end the life of a patient who is experiencing intolerable suffering and whose decline was irreversible. Usually it was reserved for people who were near the end of their natural lives. 5 years later, track two of MAID became law, and it expanded eligibility. You can now request MAID even if you are not close to death. So who are we talking about with track two? We're talking about people who are living with disabilities and who are living with chronic illness and intolerable suffering. Track two opened up MAID as a possible option for them. So that is the history of MAID in Canada so far. It's not a long history. It's just a few years, really. But it has been a consequential one. The latest stats are from 2023, and they show that MAID accounted for almost 5% of all deaths in Canada that year. 15,000 people. Think about that for a second. MAID has only been legal since 2016. And just 7 years later, almost 5% of all deaths in Canada were MAID deaths. Canada is now the number one provider of medically assisted death in the world per capita. That has attracted the attention of the United Nations. The UN has raised questions about this. The UN Committee on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities has said that it is extremely concerned with the rapid expansion of Track 2 MAID. The report raised questions about access to housing, social support, and health care, especially for people with disabilities. It noted that the suffering that qualified these people for Track 2 MAID is suffering that might have been avoided if their needs were met by the Canadian government. They asked the Canadian government to claw back Track 2 MAID. If that scenario described by the UN sounds familiar, you might remember a story that we brought you in 2021. Our reporter at the time, Cherise Suturin, Cherise spoke to a woman who was identifying herself just as Madeline at the time, but she's since come forward under her full name, Marcia Doherty. And Marcia is a person who wants to live despite her many medical ailments. However, she described back in 2021, she only wants to live if she can live with dignity, if she can live with a manageable amount of pain. And in order to live that way, she needed a certain amount of support and resources, and she wasn't getting it from our social safety net. And that's why Cherise's story was called "I Die When I Run Out of Money." Update on that story, by the way. Marcia Doherty, as of July 9th, is still alive and posting to the internet. She's been running various online fundraisers throughout the years. She became the personification of a practice that, according to some critics, a prime minister will be apologizing to the world for one day. Today we're going to meet four people, all with experience on the front lines of MAID. Some of these people have been in the room witnessing firsthand death by MAID. It would be too simple to say that the people we're going to meet today fall on both sides of the issue. The pro and the con, the yes and the no to MAID. With a subject this complex, there are not two simple sides to the argument. Within each person we talk to, there are many sides. It is messy, it is emotional, it is fraught, and it's evolving. This changes all the time. I think the best way that we can tell you these stories is simply by introducing you to the people who are experiencing this. So today, three stories. Story of the filmmaker, the writer, and the ethicist. Wait for it.
Mm-hmm. costs for medical assistance in dying are increasing across the country.
But they're not always from those with a terminal illness. We're beginning to hear more stories about people feeling it's their only recourse from
excruciating circumstances. Yeah, it's called MAID for short, and I think a lot of people don't realize that anybody physically suffering can now apply to have a medical professional to help them die.
Chapter 1, The Filmmakers. I'm Canadaland reporter Julian Abraham. What you just heard was a clip from the documentary called Life After. Here's a bit more from the film.
Okay, guys, I am rolling. What does MAID represent to you?
For me, MAID, I think, represents a way out, is how I would describe it. For most of my life, my primary caregiver was my mother. When mom got sick, even in her darkest hour when she was hospitalized, she was asking when she can, you know, sign herself out so she can come back home. When we heard mom's diagnosis, I had basically three thoughts. My first thought was, OMG, mom's going to die soon. My second thought was, OMG, I'm going to die shortly thereafter. And then I thought, OMG, how do I get my together? I didn't want to die. But at the same time, I didn't want to live an undignified life stuck in long-term care.
Here's the filmmakers, director Reed Davenport and producer Colin Cassingham.
I like to say that I make films about disability from a political perspective. Disability is too often seen as either a medical condition or a deficit that has to be overcome. Whereas I try to tell stories about disability that eliminates the social factors that discriminate against people with disabilities.
I feel like, Reed, you didn't plug yourself enough. I want to share that Reed's first film is called I Didn't See You There, and it won the directing award at Sundance Film Festival. And Life After, his second feature, also won an award at Sundance, the Special Jury Award. So this is, Reed is an incredible thinker and artist, and I was really grateful to work with him on this film.
Thank you, Colin. And ditto.
That's what a producer's for. You gotta toot your own horn. So the film takes us across several cases in the United States, contemporary stories, as well as to the Canadian context, where as we were making this film, we saw the implications of the passing of Bill C-7 unfolding from 2020 onward. And we were seeing a lot of similarities between the reasons that people were seeking Track 2 MAID, the reasons that disabled people were seeking Track 2 MAID, among them things like lack of access to affordable, accessible housing, proximity to poverty, barriers to access to the care that they needed. And those issues felt very similar to the things that we observed in the U.S., are observing in the U.S. about the ways that society makes it difficult for disabled people to thrive and how coercion and choice operate in circumstances like that.
The devaluation, the lack of support systems, the lack of employment opportunities, whether or not the media talks about it enough is another story, but they are directly dealing with the questions that were raised.
Our feelings about what's happening is that it's clear that provincial support systems, things like access to home care and cleaning and general support systems and the resources that disabled people need to thrive are being stripped away. And at the same time, access to MAID was broadened and is maybe going to expand again. And so I think we find that really frightening. And when we look at the dangers to disabled people, it feels like we're avoiding a problem instead of addressing human suffering.
And because it takes so much money for your daily living, you end up in a place where it's either living on the street or assisted dying. So I think even though it's not interpersonal coercion, it is still coercion nonetheless.
What we did hear were stories like Roger Foley's.
Hello, my name is Roger Foley. I need your help. I am the patient who has received international attention for my legal case. I am the young man who is dying of cerebellar ataxia and substantially suffering where the healthcare system and government is doing nothing to relieve my intolerable suffering and are denying me proper and necessary health care.
He claims that he didn't have access to home care that he could choose and was living in a hospital, and the doctors told him that he could either pay $1,500 a day to stay in the hospital or he could choose MAID. That feels like a pretty binary circumstance right there, where on the one hand you have this impossible so-called choice. $1,500 a day is not possible. That means that, like, he really only had one option as given by the people providing his health care. That's a direct sort of interpersonal interaction where I'm sure Roger felt like he had very little power. So I think it's also a matter of a power imbalance when you're in medical settings with doctors who our society sees as experts, that we go to them as experts many times, although the disability community knows very well that sort of a medical lens on disability is dangerous and harmful and doesn't take into full account sort of the social factors that are at fault for the inequality and discrimination they experience. So I think we're less interested in sort of bad apple, what could be written off as bad apple interactions where you maybe have an ableist doctor who is forcing someone's hand. It's less about that. The more insidious thing is the way the system is set up.
Medical professionals can be the most ableist people in the world. So yes, the systemic issue and this God complex that many doctors have is also a real issue.
I think the main thing that we want to say, not as experts, not as polemicists, like we're neither of those things. We're really just filmmakers trying to shed more light on an issue that doesn't get talked about very much. Our goal is to shine some light on the ways that ableism permeates those decisions and the systems at play.
We certainly don't want to tell people what they can and can't do, but assisted suicide in pretty much any legislative form poses a clear and present danger to disabled people. Take that as you will. I think that is at the heart of what we have found. The state sanctioning suicide encourages suicide. I don't think either of us has a fundamental opposition to suicide, but when it is legislated and the state is involved, mix that with late-stage capitalism, people will be coerced into assisted suicide where they otherwise would still be living.
My perspective certainly changed. As a non-disabled person who, before making this film with Reed, before Reed brought this film to me, I thought I knew where I stood on the issue of assisted suicide. I have progressive leftist politics, and I thought that the issue of assisted suicide was really about bodily autonomy and individual choice. I thought that I was for it. That's the default position for progressives. And so my political perspective really changed. You know, at first I was like, wow, this is so complicated. Like, there's so much gray area. How could anyone come to a clear position on this? It's so complicated. And then the next day I, you know, insight would hit, and it would really hit me that actually, it's incredibly simple. people are dying when they shouldn't be, when they have no other choice but to choose death because they don't have enough money, because they don't have access to housing. And there's a pattern here, and it's a pattern that I hate. I hate that disabled people are dying prematurely. And more universally, the issues at play here aren't just disability issues, issues that affect only the disability community. Healthcare, affordable housing, wealth inequality, these are issues that affect everyone, and they're affecting disabled people first and most acutely. But it's something that everyone should be concerned about, I think.
Our lives are seen as expensive and therefore expendable.
Chapter 2, The Writer. Katie Englehart is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. She also happens to be Canadian. She's been covering end-of-life issues around the world for years, and you're about to hear an excerpt from her recent story in the New York Times Magazine. The headline is, Do Patients Without a Terminal Illness Have the Right to Die? Our colleague Dory Smith is going to read for us.
I cannot get through a day, Paula said. It's physical torture. She wanted to know at what point she was allowed to refuse more treatment. Paula was lying in the big bed that she had pulled into the corner of the living room, facing an old TV in a window that looked out on a row of garbage bins.
For the most recent article I did about assisted dying, I watched a woman have a physician-assisted death. I was sitting in a little folding chair at the foot of her bed, and there was a lot of suffering in that room. And obviously, I experience that and feel it as a person. And also I experience it as a journalist who has sort of trained herself to be open to it. So it's not easy reporting. But then again, it's harder for everyone else in the room because everyone else in the room has a connection and a stake.
The room's brown linoleum floors were stained and its walls were mostly unadorned. On a bookshelf, there was a small figurine of an angel, her arm raised in offering.
I'm Katie Englehart. I'm a journalist and a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine. In general, I cover medicine and ethics, so sort of the big ideas and debates that take place within our healthcare system. And I guess I stumbled into this subject. I was assigned to do a project on a legal debate around assisted dying and ended up just being pulled into it. And one story has led to the other, and here I am somehow almost a decade later still reporting on assisted dying. I don't think I'm immune to the discomfort, to the darkness and the sadness, but I am able to sit with people through that. I think I have a pretty high tolerance for sitting with people through suffering and observing it. I think when you're writing about the end of life, there's a lot of dogmatism and there's a lot of cliche, and it can be really easy to slip into that, really easy to have prose that's kind of overbearing and sort of saccharine. And I try not to do that. I try to just kind of let the story speak for itself and the dialogue speak for itself. I'm not usually trying to lead the reader to any specific conclusion. So that inspires me to just tell the story and not to direct the emotional reaction of the reader.
Once, after being sent home from the hospital, Paula tried to take her own life using two plastic grocery bags. She passed out but did not suffocate. And when she woke up, gasping and tearing at the plastic, everything was worse again. Her vocal cords were damaged from the pressure on her neck, and her smooth, low voice had turned into a permanent high-pitched squeak. In June 2023, Paula went to Brockville General Hospital, a 45-minute drive from her home, to see if its ER doctors could help her. There, she was involuntarily admitted and put on a week-long psychiatric hold. 2 months later, Paula took a taxi to a different hospital in Ottawa. She asked, "Do you guys do MAID?" Again, she was placed on a psychiatric hold, this time for 3 weeks. By then, MAID was in the air. That year,
15,343 Canadians. One out of 20 who died received a physician-assisted death, making Canada the number one provider of assisted dying in the world when measured in total figures. This just 7 years after the procedure was legalized in Canada.
In Canada right now, the main opposition to Track 2 MAID comes from the disability rights community, disability rights advocates, who argue that basically people with disabilities are coerced into choosing this kind of death because of the system, because the way the system marginalizes them, because of the fact that disability benefits in every single province and territory, they fall below the poverty line, because people with disabilities are forced so often to apologize for their needs, to beg for almost nothing. So they argue that in this context, it's basically impossible to make a voluntary choice to have an assisted death. On the other hand, there are people who say, this is our system, and people have to be able to make autonomous choices given inequality. Or they dispute the premise that people are making these choices because of financial reasons or marginalization to begin with. And I think I've seen, particularly in the response to my recent reporting, a huge amount of pain and fear voiced from that community. And I understand that. These are people who are saying, hey, help me to live better. Don't offer me an avenue towards death. But I think on the other hand, there's a tendency to say that a person with a disability is by definition vulnerable and thus can never be making an autonomous choice. And I don't think that's true. And I'm not sure the right response is to deny marginalized people access to choices.
The pain was worse than anything she had ever felt, and Paula had always been in pain. Over the years, she had collected varied and sometimes competing diagnoses: fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, chronic pain, chronic migraine. Also, bipolar disorder, borderline personality disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, anxiety, substance use disorder, marijuana. Paula told a friend that a veterinarian would put a dog down for feeling better than she did.
I can't tell you how many people have told me some variation of the story. You know, my dad pulled me aside one day and he told me, if I ever get dementia or if I ever have a brain injury and I don't know who I am and I'm using diapers, I want you to end my life. I want you to promise me. Like, I can't tell you how many people have told me that a relative has pulled them aside and asked for that, has asked them to make that kind of promise. And so in these cases, people are expressing the hope that if they don't have the capacity to make a choice, but they seem to be suffering or seem to be unknown to themselves, that someone else will step in. I think a lot of people say, sure, or, you know, I'll find a way. And I think most people haven't thought through exactly what it means to make a promise like that. And I think in most cases, it's a promise they won't keep. As someone who's never, thankfully, dealt with a medical condition that could qualify, I think it's just impossible to imagine. And I think in my reporting, like, my years of reporting have taught me humility. You know, you can imagine yourself into someone else's life and you can learn as much as you can about someone's life and the context in which they're making a decision. But ultimately, you can't get yourself all the way there and you don't know. Honestly, it would be impossible for me to know.
When Dr. Wanacott came in, he was carrying a black leather doctor's bag. He told Paula that he hadn't scheduled anything else for the rest of the day and that things could go as quickly or as slowly as she needed them to. Paula wanted to know how long it would take for her to die. From the time the meds are in until you're gone, 5 or 10 minutes, Wanacott said. But from your perspective, a minute. When everyone entered the living room, the lights were dim and Paula was lying with a beige blanket pulled around her chest. She said she was ready. I'm going to take Paula's hand now, Wanacott said softly. Now? Now. For days, Paula had worried that at the final moment, she would waver, as she did when she tried to take her life before, pick up the pills, put them down, pick them up again, wade into the river, swim back, over and over. She imagined that when Wanacott reached for the syringe, she would flinch. But Paula was calm and still as the drugs went in. "I don't feel anything," she whispered. "You will." "Oh, wow," she said. "This is horrible. I'm just so sorry." Paula coughed as if she might vomit. Deep, guttural hacks. After a few moments, her body relaxed. A wet tissue fell from her hands. Her skin slowly turned a pale white. Wanacott pressed his stethoscope to Paula's chest. "It's over."
Chapter 3, The Bioethicist.
How you doing?
Pleased to meet you.
Yes, nice to meet you.
Come on in.
Hey, thank you.
Yo, this is video, it's audio, right?
It's just audio.
Yeah, I don't need.
So it's audio, you are okay here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We're good.
Thank you.
Terry Bowman's job is to be there when patients and their families are staring death in the face.
Would you like a coffee?
I would love a coffee.
So come with me because we can select which kind you're going to get.
I will. Thank you.
He's a bioethicist. That means he helps families and healthcare professionals make more informed choices when it comes to ethical matters. These are often urgent things that come up in medical settings, and they're often life or death. He told me he can't decide this stuff for them, but he can at least help them figure out what exactly is on the line and which ethical considerations they need to weigh. When MAID first became law in 2016, it brought up a whole new set of questions for him.
We went from doing something that would have put us in jail to something that was considered compassionate healthcare almost overnight. And for those of us in the healthcare field, that was radical. A lot of my working life has been end-of-life cases, people coming off life support machines, those types of, you know, including neonatal intensive care. My working life preceded medical assistance in dying, so I was working in hospitals where if you ever did something like that, you would literally be on a homicide charge. The state, our government, the government of Canada, although they wouldn't use the words, they've had to take a position that some kind of lives are not worth living. And whether any government should ever do that is questionable. But although they'd never use that language, one would argue, including me, that they kind of already have. I see medical assistance in dying as a culture shift, actually, that there's an increasing movement towards what kind of lives are worth living. I see this at the beginning of life as well, because I do that, but that would be a separate interview. But in terms of what kind of babies people want, and, you know, with genetic testing and genetic screening and those types of things. So I actually see a culture shift going on in terms of what kind of lives are acceptable. When people living with disabilities say this dehumanizes us, I'm not disabled, but I get their point. When you look at, you know, how did medical assistance in dying emerge in countries like Belgium and Holland? It was actually physicians, and physicians said, you know, we're coming across these patients and they've got lots of pain and they're not recovering and death is approaching, and physicians felt we need to talk to the government. Nothing like that happened in Canada. I was in the healthcare system, and I still am then, meaning before it was legalized. Most healthcare workers were horrified by the thought of it. It was never coming from healthcare workers. It was the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedom, which I'm not against. I think it's a very good thing. But it really, really was driven by the Charter. So it was really originally coming from a very different place than the medical system saying we need to do more to help our patients. And the expansion has come from, you know, the Charter challenges. Why this person but not that person? So it's always through the lens of rights. But what we miss is the kind of supports that are often needed to help people. There's three major dilemmas now facing medical assistance in dying in Canada. You know, one is the potential for medical assistance in dying, which is presently illegal, where a primary diagnosis is a mental health disorder.
Okay, let's break this down for a minute. There's track one MAID, that's the original one that